I want to thank you guys for inviting me to see what you guys are doing in your community. It's very exciting stuff. And I'm not exactly sure how much this work on N equals 8 and pure gravity, straight vanilla, you know, perturbation theory is going to help you too much. And so I was trying to think of what I could bring to you. I'm a graduate student at UCLA. It's not that far from Hollywood. And when I get my PhD later this year, Arnold Schwarzenegger, the governor, is going to be signing it. So that gave me an idea that I could talk about how to play an action hero while avoiding Lagrangians. And so unlike you guys, who are real action heroes, right, this is playing a Hollywood action hero. I never actually see an action or use Feynman diagrams. All my work is done with on-shelf physical quantities. But you can climb to pretty high loop orders, which looks like a lot of action. So let me tell you what I want you to get out of this talk, what I hope you get out of this talk. When organized well, these perturbative calculations are straightforward and fun. Okay, they're not overly laborious or painful. Also, I'd like to get across the idea that there's something deep going on between gauge and gravity theories, sort of a weak unification that Arkady mentioned a little earlier. And the last thing is that just normal perturbative quantum field theory may be a more powerful framework for exploring gravity theories than people have suspected for quite some time. So that's what I hope you'll leave with. You'll notice I'm not saying I hope you leave believing N equals 8 is finite. As Arkady mentioned, this is not a rigorous argument, but I'll show you some of what's going on. So this is the outline. I'll discuss these on-shell techniques and how they clarify relationships between gauge and gravity theories. I'll take you on a tour of some of the cancellations we've seen as we've been exploring maximally supersymmetric gravity. And then I'll take a look at pure gravity to help explain maybe some of the stuff that we're seeing. Okay, so it's a question. Why are Feynman diagrams so difficult for high loop or high multiplicity processes? And the answer is actually really straightforward. It's when you calculate the Feynman diagram, you need to keep track of all this off-shelf stuff, this unphysical stuff, right? And it's important. I mean, this is what gives you the quantum in your field theory, right? But it's not that fun to play with. And to avoid the trouble of playing with this stuff that's not that fun, it actually punishes you, we reorganize perturbative quantum field theory calculations. We do all our steps using gauge invariant on-shell states, on-shell formulas. Okay. And so it goes by the name of unitarity method. And this is actually not such a young spring chicken anymore. This has been around for over 15 years, built by these guys in the 90s to look at Thorne calculations and one loops. And it's a way of perturbatively quantizing massless gauge and gravity theories. And by that, I mean building higher loops out of lower loops and trees. And there have been recent advances that feed into the way we currently do these calculations. Now, one thing I often get is when I start talking about four loop calculation, maximal supergravity, is, oh, what a monstrous, big, brutish calculation these four loop calculations must be. And if you take away anything from this next section, I hope it's not a big monster calculation. It's a series of delightful straightforward calculations. Okay, And so I'll show you how that works. And the way it works is you consider all topologies that can contribute to an amplitude, like a four loop amplitude. And what you do is you fix the contributions of these topologies by considering what happens when you take all the particles on shell these topologies. Now that's not all possible contributions, right? But those are contributions that have to be there. And then you go looking for bits you might have left, off-shell contributions you might have left. But so I'm talking about actually literally describing this in terms of three vertex on-shell trees. Three particle on-shell trees. And you feed in your four trees, right? And that's relaxing cut conditions. And so you make sure you didn't, so you capture bits that you may have dropped just looking here, right? And you consider five trees and so on and so forth, until you've released all your cut conditions. Now I realize this is abstract and cartoony, so I'm actually going to take you through a two-loop calculation and maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. And you'll see how straightforward it is. Okay, so you find all your cubic diagrams. and why only cubic diagrams, right? Because you can get any higher point. So if I want a higher point interaction, like a four-point interaction, I can take this guy who represents the denominator, or his topology, he represents the denominator. I can multiply him. This guy's an L. I can multiply him by L squared, right, to bring these two three-point trees to a four-point interaction. You see? Everybody with you'll see this. Okay, but with cubic diagrams, I can span everything. Okay, so these are going to be the palette of our integrands, and they're also going to be our first cuts. What we're going to do is we're going to take these guys, and we're going to put their particles on shell. So there are only two non-vanishing maximals. These are maximal cuts, and we cut all of our propagates, put them all on shell. There are only two that are non-vanishing, Fermi equals four superyang metals. Right, there's this guy, and by non-vanishing I mean you actually put. So I wrote this out explicitly. You put cubic trees, these cubic trees, here, on every vertex, and you sum over all the particles that can cross these cuts, and these are on-shell amplitudes. And when you do this and you shake it, you get a remarkably simple expression at the end: k1 plus k2 squared. That's the contribution of this guy when all the propagators are cut. All these guys are on-shell. Okay. I'm dropping an overall factor that appears in front of all four-point Yang-Mills graphs. I said there were two. Here's the other guy, non-planar double blocks. Again, you do the same thing. Right, and some of them, you actually find it's K1 plus K2 squared. And all other topologies, when you put all the legs on shell and you sum over all the states, they all vanish. So at the end of this step, we know there are numerator factors, K1 and K2 squared, associated with those two guys. Now, there might be additional terms proportional to an L squared. So if this guy we call an L, right, maybe there's something like this, right, that we would have missed from that layer, from cutting all the propagators, right? But if this guy's missing, we'll find him as we go to the next step. Actually, maximally supersymmetric Yang-Mills, we've already saturated the power counting, right? So there are not going to be any terms like this that we're missing. So we'll see how that plays out. Okay, so we relax cut conditions. There are only five isomorphically distinct and non-trivially vanishing single contact cuts, and so we'll look at one of them. It's this guy, and you sew in a four tree, all these three trees. And you do the cut, and by doing the cut, you sum over all the particles crossing this product of trees, and you find this expression, K1 plus K2 squared over L5 minus K3 squared. And so the question we're asking ourselves now is that, is this accounted for by our current ansatz? Or do we need to add new contributions? Okay. Oh yeah, sure. Okay.
Hopefully on that.
Right.
And that's enough to have everything on shell, I guess.
Yeah.
So you can extract it from these computations.
So, so we don't have the full amplitude. Well, actually, we do have the full amplitude. Well, I'll show you the full amplitude. So, were there other questions?
Go ahead, I'll ask.
Yeah.
Yeah. Intermediate function, momental, complex.
Yeah, yes, absolutely complex.
Now we have L5 in the input.
Pardon me?
Now we have L5 in the.
Yep.
Which is complex.
Sure. Absolutely.
I mean, that's what I mean. If the external lines are on shell,
And all exposed propagators on shell. So this guy.
So you have something that doesn't exist in Minkowski space.
No. Yeah.
You have a three-point
that's
function with three massless particles on shell.
That's absolutely right.
So in Minkowski space, that doesn't exist.
Yes, that doesn't exist.
So this, what space is this in?
No, well, so this isn't the full amplitude. I mean, this isn't the full amplitude yet. This is a piece of the amplitude. Okay, so this is actually a check to make sure that what we believe the answer gives all cuts in all channels. And you give all cuts in all channels d-dimensionally, independent of what momenta you stick in, whether you're sticking in complex momenta or real momenta, as long as you reproduce all cuts in all channels, you have the final answer d-dimensionally. Right. So we're building an ansatz. Right, our ansatz doesn't depend on complex momenta. Our ansatz is a set of diagrams with numerator factors. These are integrands. Right, when you do the integral in Minkowski space, right? Well, and you'll do it d-dimensionally. You'll do, you know, right? We regulate with dimensional regularization. But in the construction of this ansatz, right, we feel completely free to do this, to do formally, to stick in complex momenta, to make sure we're not dropping any pieces. Okay? So when we integrate, I mean, we're going to integrate momentum. And these guys are formally going to be real momenta. I mean, you know, incoming, you know, outgoing, a scattering amplitude, honest scattering amplitude.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, scattering amplitudes are summed over Feynman diagrams. The Feynman diagrams. I mean, whenever you get confused with this, you always go back to Feynman diagrams.
But if I just start with the all of Lagrangian, we know I can't get a free point vertex with all three lines massless and on shell. That won't exist. If I start with a Lagrangian field for that, I won't be able to handle the sample.
You're saying, well, actually, you know what? I'm going to show you. I mean, why don't we come back to this in a few slides?
I'm just saying, normally when we start with a Lagrangian field theorem, we make Feynman graphs.
Right.
Then we see in the graphs we can relate back to the properties of the Lagrangian. But you have something that is special.
So what I am saying is, I'm saying all the information in the S matrix is going to be in the tree level amplitudes. If you poke at them the right way, you can extract it. So this is a way of extracting information from tree level, and you can calculate the tree level amplitudes of your theory using Feynman diagrams.
So I'm explaining this mechanism just because I want you guys to have insight to how we actually calculate. What we're not doing is we're not writing down the 10 to the 30 Feynman diagrams to contribute to a three-loop cut, right? What we're doing is we're organizing the having already written them down and actually taking them into very simple forms at tree level, and then probing that to get at what the loop contributions are. Okay, so as I say, you do the cut and you get this expression. So the question is, have I accounted for everything the way I've already dressed my cubic diagrams, or are there missing pieces? And the way you answer that question is by drawing pictures. So you take this four-point color order blob, and you expand it out in terms of its T channel and its S channel, and you dress according to what I discovered at the previous cut level, when I had things all propagators on shell. When I do that, I have K1 plus K2 squared over L5 minus K2 squared, and this matches the cut calculation, so I know there were no missing contributions, either parent dressing from this contact cut. In fact, for N equals 4 super Young mills, there's no missing contributions on any cuts, but there would be for QCD, right? And this is this is how we do QCD calculations. It's the exact same method. So here's a prescription for incorporating contact contributions. So you identify, so at any given cut level, you identify all the cuts that have bits that weren't accounted for in your ansatz that you've constructed from previous levels, right? Those missing bits represent a set of equations from missing numerator dressings. You can simultaneously solve them, and the solutions represent where you assign them, which cubic graphs you assign them to. If this is an over-constrained system, then you've actually done something wrong, right? Typically, it's under-constrained. You have some freedom to how you assign it, and you may not actually feel like solving a set of linear cut equations. You know, four loops, maybe not such a problem, but at six loops, definitely, that's a lot of things to be solving simultaneously for N equals 4 degree angles anyway. And so a question you can ask is, which topologies should you assign contact terms to when given the freedom? And there are a number of different types of correct answers. Whichever makes your final expression the most compact is maybe the right answer. But maybe you're not so interested in compactness. You're interested in getting insight into higher loop orders. And so you're interested in looking for iterative structure that you can see manifestly. And we do see this in theories like N equals 4 super angles. There is iterative structure that we can actually exploit when looking at higher loops. But this is actually a really hard thing to solve until you've done the calculation. And this is really hard to solve if you don't know what the iterative structure is, right? So I can't answer this question. I can't say what's the right way to assign them. So I don't know the right way. But I can tell you a strategy that closes at four loops for N equals 8 supergravity. And if By close, I mean a way that for every cut, I don't have to speak to anybody else. At the given cut level, I can give you some, and I can go off and do some. And then we just come back at the end, and we just adjust our notes and go on to the next cut level. And that strategy is you assign the missing contact contribution to the cubic diagram that has the least symmetry that contributed least to the cut. And that's something that closes or flow loops. It means it doesn't lead to any contradictions. Okay. So I said these on-shell methods give some insight into relationships between gauge theory and gravity amplitude. And so to look at this, let's look at three vertices, the cubic Feynman diagrams from our theories, from pure Yang-Mills and pure Einstein-Hilbert gravity, and the Dondra gauge. And you see the three gluon vertex. You have our color factor here, and our momentum-dependent kinetic factor, coupling constant, and it's not that scary a beast. But you look at your three graviton vertex, and it's a big, huge mess. And it's actually it's way messier than I wrote. I cheated by sticking things in terms of permutations. Here there's six permutations, here there's three permutations. And I have to symmetrize over all my indices. And so my Feynman diagram, my three vertex is a big nasty mess. And if you look at it for a while, you may say to yourself, maybe I want to go calculate something else. But this is with case where it's off shell. It turns out when you put your momentum on shell, something absolutely beautiful happens. Nothing happens to the gauge theory amplitude, exactly the same. But look at what happened to the gravity amplitude. It's the square. It's exactly the square of the gauge theory amplitude. On the three vertex, this is just a Feynman diagram. When you just throw away all the k-squareds, right, from your three vertex Feynman diagram. And it turns out any gravity scattering amplitude is constructible solely from the on-shell three vertex. And this is a known and proven thing. Any tree amplitude. And this is due to the work of Byrne, Kurtazov, Fang, and Witten, on-shell recursion relations for tree amplitudes, originally for gauge theory. But it's been extended to all sorts of theories. And this proof, there are two really nice proofs, so a d-dimensional proof given by Arkani, Hamed, and Kaplan, maybe it was 2 years ago now, and also Tony Hall. And so so you have your tree amplitudes all from the three vertex, all from the on-shell three vertex, and you can use the unitarity method to go on to loops. Here's something curious. Now, this is actually something we discovered about tree-level amplitudes on the way to for loops. And so this is something new about tree levels we discovered calculating the for loops. So here's the gauge theory three vertex again, right? You've got a color factor and momentum-dependent kinematic factors. And the structure constants given in terms of the trace of the group theory generators, the adjoint representation. And our color factors are managing too many tools. So color factors over here is the Jacobi identity, right? And this is just a pictorial way of writing the Jacobi identity. You can have the U contribution to the four-point amplitude, and you address each vertex with its color amplitude, and you've got the S contribution to the four-point amplitude, the C contribution to the four-point amplitude. And this is just the Jacobi identity. You flip the order and you flip it around. And it's exactly what's in the textbooks. Okay, so now let's look at the four-point amplitude. We know there's a missing Feynman diagram for the four-point amplitude, right? It's this guy, right? We can assign this guy to these guys, to any of these guys, because if I multiply this guy, who has a U in the denominator, by a U, K1 plus KP squared, right, I get this contribution. So I can assign these three guys. I can write down my gauge theory amplitude, full color dress gauge theory amplitude, in terms of a sum over a kinematic factor associated with this guy, that's polarization, then momentum, you know, the whole business, times color factor over over this propagator, plus the F sign, same contribution to S diagram, and the contribution to the T diagram. And something really interesting. And this is just, I mean, independent of how you assign this guy to any of these guys, the color factor obeys the Jacobi identity. Right, this is the color factor associated with U. Turns out the numerator factor, this kinematic numerator factor, also obeys the same identity. This is actually something that we didn't know about, and we were very startled to find out. We actually found out that somebody didn't know about it in the early 80s. But it turns out, and this is I think what nobody knew, is that that this generalizes to higher points. And so the claim is that you can always write gauge tree amplitudes in terms of a color factor, numerator factor times tree diagrams, where for any of the diagrams, if the color factors satisfy the Jacobi identity, then the numerator factors will also satisfy the Jacobi identity. And this is a claim. We worked it out explicitly to high multiplicity, I think, for all sorts of, so this is just pure Yang-Mill for gluons, for all sorts of helicity states to 8, and then, but you can look for all sorts of things, the higher points, like MHG guys are trivial to calculate with, and you can check this empirically to much higher orders, and it turns out, all things related via supersymmetric word identities, all gauge amplitudes related to supersymmetric word identities, you can do this too. These are gauge dependent quantities, right? These are not gauge invariant. In fact, if you take Feynman diagrams and all sorts of gauges and you do this, you have to organize. You have to organize the amplitude into this form, color factor times numerator factor, or the numerator factor to the identity. But it turns out the fact that you can do this places a non-trivial constraint on amplitudes, and on color ordered amplitudes. Previously, it was believed that there were n minus 2 factorial color ordered amplitudes that you could fix the order of 2 of your particles, and the rest would run around freely. Turns out they're actually n minus 3 independent color order amplitudes. And it turns out this was has recently been, just this past summer, been proven by some of our string theory friends on the string theory side. But when they take it down the low energy limit, they reproduce the relations we found between color ordered gauge theory amplitudes. It's interesting, it's curious, but what does that do for us? Well, okay. So now I'm going to show you this big, ugly expression. This is a big, ugly, wonderful expression. This is on the string theory, so this was found in the late 80s by Kawhi Lowell and Tai. It's a relationship between gravity scattering amplitudes. You can always express it into a sum over products of gauge theory amplitudes. Turns out you can take the low energy limit. And this holds for gravity amplitudes, quantum field theory gravity amplitudes, pure gravity, you know, minus 2 and plus 2 helicity, my gravitons, right? I can express in terms of pure Yang-Mills gauge theory amplitudes. And it works for, you know, supersymmetric extensions, so n equals 8, n equals 4, and n equals 4. And you see, I distinguish between gauge amplitudes with a tilde and gauge amplitudes without a tilde. I think for string theorists, that would be left and right mover. But we don't have left and right moving on field theory, but you can stick in a different theory. So this could be n equals 4, and this could be n equals 2, and I get a different gravity theory on the other side. Anyway, I'm showing you this mostly because, I mean, it's interesting. This has been useful for us in calculations relating gravity scattering amplitudes to gauge theory scattering amplitudes, which are easier to calculate. But there's something that's important, which is that our relations actually allow us to rewrite this very mysterious, confusing permutations. And now a sort of trivial way allows us to rewrite it is we can make it, for example, left and right symmetric. Right? These aren't symmetric in terms of color orders. We can choose all sorts of different color orders. That's actually not all exciting. We can do better. And the way we do better is we go back to our gauge dependent organization, where we organize our gauge theory amplitudes in terms of color factors and numerator factors that obey the same algebra. If we do that and we stick it into the color ordered gauge theory amplitudes here and here, and we shake it, we find something miraculous. The entire mess turns into this. right? So this is a true thing. I mean, this is a verified thing through, I think, 8 or 9 points now explicitly. But we don't have a proof, but this is a true thing, right? And it's really interesting. But this you kind of have a hint of, I mean, you might have an ability to understand, give you something, a hair you can pull to start tweaking out this field theoretic relation between gravity and gauge theory, whereas the other guy was a big headache. And one reason the other guy was a big headache is because not only was it expressing gravity amplitudes in terms of gauge theory amplitudes, but it had convolved in it the factor n minus 3 factorial independent gauge theory amplitudes for given multiplicity. Okay, so this is useful for higher loop calculations. And as I said, we discovered this accidentally on our way to our for loop calculation, so we didn't actually have a lot of time to ponder it. We wrote our paper and we put it out, but we went back to calculating because the one thing about a for loop calculation, you kind of have to just do it. If you stop, it's hard to pick up momentum again, even though it is a delightful calculation. So anyway, this is actually something I want to get back to thinking about this guy, and this is something that's really kind of on my near-term agenda. You know, is there a physical principle involved in this? I think for string theorists, it's a straightforward, you know, it's left and right moving, you know, things. But is there any insight on field theory? Is it just a consequence of being able to take a Lorentz limit? Right.
Get a scalar theory, right? I don't know.
It's something that occurred to us, and we speculated about. We actually, in our first draft, we had speculated, but we ended up public, and we ended up putting this in Pet PH because it was mostly a gauge theory paper. So we, but I don't know. That's actually a good question.
Okay, so I'm going to move on. But this is an example of something interesting
and true, I think really true, that we discovered about tree amplitudes is not obvious. It's an organization, but it's a really interesting organization. We didn't invent the Quayle-Lampi relations, right? But this is a really interesting organization. So that was my on-shell methods and ways of clarifying gauge and gravity amplitudes, or relations between gauge and gravity amplitudes. Now I'm going to take on this tour of remarkable cancellations observed in N=8 supergravity. Okay, so here's the exciting proposition. There's a perturbatively finite quantum field theory of gravity in 4 dimensions. And this is an incredibly surprising proposition from the standpoint of not doing anything interesting or fascinating with field theory, just, you know, straight up perturbative calculation. And we all know why it's surprising if possible. But it comes down to the fact that the coupling constant is dimensionful, and so for every vertex, I have 2 copies of loop momentum relative to 1 copy for gauge theory and some loop order that's just going to blow up. So any responsible mechanism that could make up the difference between this and this naively on individual Feynman diagrams, we think would impact our understanding of gravity. And so. The evidence, so there's evidence, right? And it's spectacular cancellations in N=8 supergravity. Everywhere we look, and we can look pretty far in certain ways, everywhere we look, N=8 supergravity has the same power counting as N=4 superyang mills, a theory known to be finite, specifically as a critical dimension of 4 plus 6 over L. Everywhere we look, and if you take L to infinity, then you have a finite theory, 4 dimensions, if this holds. Okay, and so I'm just going to show you some of the cancellations we've seen. Now, even though these methods end up leading to very delightful and fun calculations, you don't do calculations just because you want to be delighted and have fun. You have to have a reason. And even 3 loops, you know, for Maxwell supersymmetric supergravity, you really want a reason to calculate it. Here are the theories. I mean, just for those who aren't all that familiar with it, N=8 supergravity has 256 massless space from -2 elicited -2 to +2. n equals 4 to the null 16 state is a factorization of the spectra. Okay, so opinions from the 80s. So there's a lot of beliefs around three loops. And these are quotes we just like to bring up because they make us feel good. If certain patterns that emerge should persist in the higher orders of perturbation theory, then n equals 8 supergravity in four dimensions would have ultraviolet divergences starting at three loops. This is our recently appointed Lucasian friend and his friends in younger days. There are no miracles. It is therefore very likely that all supergravity theories will diverge at three loops in four dimensions. The final word on these issues, we have to wait further explicit calculations. And we really like this quote because it suggests maybe we should do some calculations. But you'd have to have a reason to believe that you might actually find something. I mean, these are fun things to do, but you have to have a reason to hope that you might find something interesting. And so I'm going to give you the background to that hope. And it comes down to a remarkable one-loop property of maximally supersymmetric supergravity and actually n equals 4 superyang mills as well that propagates to all loop orders in a very interesting way. So we know that we can take all one-loop amplitudes, massless amplitudes, and decompose them into bubbles, triangles, and boxes. And the bubbles have worst power counting, the boxes have best power counting, and the new triangle property of n equals 8 supergravity is that there are no triangles and no bubbles, that it stops at boxes. One-loop supergravity, you'd only decompose down to boxes. Okay, and this actually has a non-trivial constraint on the analytic forms of the amplitudes. And this is actually a proven and known thing, proven by Arcani. So these are all people who calculated and found instances where this was true, right? Calculated, okay, this is definitely true. 7, 8, 9 gravitons interacting. But this was actually proven by Arkani Hamed, Bethesda and Kaplan, and Jeremy Bohr and Pierre Van Hove. And one of the things that Jeremy Bohr and Van Hove recognized is that the unordered nature of gravity is actually very important to this property. That'll come back a little later. I'm just pointing that out here. Okay, so one loop, who cares? This is not color. So for people who do a lot of calculations in n equals 4 or in gauge theories, you're used to extracting the color. So expressing the amplitudes in terms, you pull out the group theory away from the kinematics. And then we can do very simple things with the kinematics. The kinematics is then color ordered. It's pegged, right, associated with the color free factor you have. And so it's actually kind of a very static thing. I'll come back to this in a bit. Okay. All right, so here's this elegant observation of Z-Lanthan I do that actually got us excited enough to actually do a three-loop calculation. And so this is the best behaved n-loop Yang-Mills integral, the ladder diagram, and nothing gets better than a ladder, right? For every rung in your diagram, you get another factor of k plus kb squared, right? So this guy comes in at, you know, k plus kb squared to n minus 1, right? Ladder diagram. So we take this guy, we put him on his side, and we look at the one higher loop up from adjoining a tree like this, and what had been external momentum becomes internal or loop momentum. This is the worst behaved n plus 1 loop Yang-Mills amplitude, right? It just is, and it's there. That's fine. I mean, it's finite, and it's no problem, but it is there. Now, let's see what happens when you do the same thing for gravity. This is a best behaved n-loop supergravity integral. It's just like Yang-Mills, but squared, right? As it would need to be, actually, for dimensionality reasons. But now, something absolutely horrendous happens when you consider what happens when you turn this guy on his side. You go up a loop level. And all of a sudden, all this external momentum becomes loop momentum. It goes loop momentum to the fourth power, n minus 1. This is an absolutely horrendously behaved integral. Some loop momentum, this would definitely diverge if this is present. There aren't cancellations. You can do, though, you can ask yourself by considering this cut, this diagram, consider this cut, and you isolate this one loop amplitude. And this one loop amplitude sends out this power counting severely violates the no triangle property of this one loop, severely. And if you take into account all the cancellations that would need to occur between all the diagrams that contribute to this cut, you see cancellation that bring you right back to the power counting of n equals 4 cubed angles. And this touches a lot of topologies, tremendous number of topologies. And this goes to all loop order. But it's not a proof, because there's stuff it doesn't touch, and there are bits that are on itself. Right? I mean, this isn't a proof, but they're cancellations, and they're cancellations that seem stronger than any known supersymmetry argument. Right? And we knew, I mean, so the belief is, you know, supersymmetry runs out. It's a protection, but it's a protection that runs out. And so you'd need to see a hint of something beyond supersymmetry to even begin to think that maybe there's something to find. Right? And so this is that hint. It's not a proof. But there's something important, there's something that stimulated us to calculate higher loops. So here's the full three loop calculation. You need these cuts. This spans the space. There's no way anything off shell can be hiding from these cuts. And the nice thing is okay, and so we know with three loop n equals 4 superangles is. And we can actually recycle that information to calculate n equals 8 on these cuts, because a very beautiful property of the KLT relations, that the supersum over maximum supersymmetric supergravity cut factorizes via KLT into a sum over permutation of the of n equals the gauge theory on that cut with a permutation of external legs times the gauge theory on that cut, the permutation of external legs. Just to take you back to diagrams, like this guy factorizes into a sum over permutations of this leg ordering of this cut and this cut. And if you know what this guy is, the full off-shell expression for this amplitude, then the way you get this guy is just by drawing pictures and dressing them the way you know your basis is dressed. So we have a complete three loop n equals 8 supergravity result. And here it is. It fits on one page. Maybe you can't read it, but this is actually remarkable how simple this result is. I mean, this is the type of thing you always find when you do calculations, right? Is that you'd start, especially with Feynman, you'd start with a big mess, but, you know, eventually you can always simplify it away to something nice and reasonable. I mean, there's structure behind this stuff. And so not only is this guy finite in four dimensions, it's actually finite for d less than 6, matching n equals 4 superangles. We actually integrated to make sure there was a UV pole in six dimensions, so it actually saturated the critical dimension. It didn't behave better than n equals 4 superangles. You had no reason to expect it would. And so it's identical power count as n equals 4 superangles. Okay, so that's actually a good calculation. Now, why go after four loops? You've got three loops. Well, it turns out, so you see these guys? These guys are all ladder-like diagrams, right? So these guys aren't going to have worse behavior than n equals 4 superangles. The functions just external momentum, the remainders are. These guys are the only, these were the first places that that things could be expected to diverge. They were constrained by the new triangle property, many of them, maybe not this guy. But many of them were constrained. But it's not a lot of data to go on. If you don't know what the symmetry is, right, or the dynamical mechanism behind possible cancellations that you're observing, right, you want data to sift through, data to find structure in. So to find structure responsible for cancellations, we wanted more data. And so that's one reason for calculating four loops. Another is after we calculated three loops, our supersymmetry friends found a supersymmetric argument for why it couldn't have happened at three loops. In fact, with this new formalism, it suggests that maximal supergravity is likely to diverge at four loops and v equals 5. and for loops is within our grasp. And it kindly said, unless other infinity suppression mechanisms not involving supersymmetry or gauge invariance are worked. So with this gauntlet thrown, and something we could actually reach and probe. So now, I should point out that doing this calculation doesn't invalidate their argument, but certainly constrains it, right? So here's 50 integral topologies. These are parent diagrams for four loop n equals four super angles. So these are the guys, cubic diagrams. So we certainly get a lot of data after calculating. And how do we get them? Well, by a series of delightful calculations. And so this is what happens. That's actually a series of 2,906 delightful calculations gets you the full answer. Gets you four loop n equals eight super gravity. But you want to verify. So that's a way of building it up, right? You want to verify that you have everything. You verify the completeness on 26 cuts. And I showed the interesting cuts. The other cuts aren't so interesting. Actually, kind of trivial sort of iterated two particle cuts. Okay, but after you do these, you know you've got the answers. Nothing, nowhere, any off shell stuff to be hiding. You've got everything. And yeah. Well, so the two aspects of this. It's not really like pushing a button. I mean, so. Maybe I come back to the automation at the end. We can talk about that. So a lot of things. So a lot of the process. A lot of these things are very easy to automate. So there's sort of their gross motor skills that go into this, like drawing trees, checking to see if graphs are isomorphic, dressing graphs, and that type of stuff's very easy to automate. And actually doing the algebra is also fairly straightforward. So a lot of it is automated at the end, but that doesn't mean so a lot of the thinking really goes into calculating n equals 4 super angles amplitude. Once you have that, the d-dimensional n equals 4 super angles amplitude, then going and getting gravity is fairly straightforward. But the reason it took us so long was making sure we had the n equals 4. And so, and that's not quite such an automated process. Yeah.
Playing is fine. Or, I mean.
Okay, so I'm going to get to that, right? Yeah, so. Oh, and the next question?
How hard is to add one more external leg?
How hard is it to add one more external leg? That's a really good question. That's something, I mean, we discussed. It's a little tricky. I mean, there's some nice properties about four-point amplitudes, which is that it's just like four points for these series. You only have MHG configurations, right? And you can actually factorize the tree out in front that contains all that. And so you're just working with these nice functions. With 5 points, it's trickier. Yeah.
But it's tricky already at 3 loops.
Yeah, it's tricky already at 3 loops. But it's not impossible. The question, so you want a reason to do it. You want a reason to do it. And actually, there's so right now I'm talking about a 4.4 loop package. I'll say that. Now I said there was a price to pay for my strategy that closed, right? For being able to do things independently, being able to send various people running off by themselves. And not having to compare or solve a set of linear equations for missing contact terms. And the price you pay is in order to peg things to diagrams in such a way they don't bleed into other cuts, you introduce what's potentially artificially bad power counting. So you're pegging things to diagrams by multiplying by inverse propagators, which are L squareds, right? And so that's how I pegged it. And you actually go up to four levels of collapsed propagators to make sure you're capturing everything. And so on the end, we had leading numerators that looked like LP8, which is four powers of the momentum worse than 8 sports super mills, and would have a divergence, a critical dimension of 4.5. It turns out these guys are represented by integrals which just cancel the full amplitude, and the full amplitude, you sum over permutations of external legs, these guys just drop right out. nothing interesting there. The self-leading divergence L to the 7 also, I mean, just trivially vanishes under integration by Lorentz invariance. The bit that actually required a little work in terms of analyzing divergence is actually the important bit about actually matching the critical dimension of any force engineering nulls was looking at these L to the 6 guys. And these guys correspond to the five-dimensional divergence postulated by Stell and friends. And so the way you go after these guys, you expand the integrands around small external momenta. And you get contributions from the guys who are manifestly L to the 6 and those guys who are L to the 7, whatever property is, L to the 8, whatever property it is. Now, the thing is, there are many ways of expanding the contributing integrands in terms of independent momenta, right? Each way of expanding around independent momenta must be equivalent order by order in small external momenta. And equating these expansions result in novel integral identities. And it turns out these novel integral identities are sufficient to completely constrain these guys to vanish. I have pictures of two of the novel integrals. So these actually represent integrals. These dots represent doubled propagators. We're expanding around small external momenta. External momenta goes away. Propagators that were different, you know, double up. But it turns out you find identities like this by just expanding around different basis of independent momenta, different labels of independent momenta. You do that, but they have to be equivalent, right? Because you're always talking about the same thing. All these guys vanish. And we also verify by explicit integration of these guys that that they vanish. And so what do we know? In the end, the for loop 4-point n equals 8 supergravity is finite in 5 dimensions. Now, so this does two things for us. It constrains a potential supersymmetry explanation of our 3-loop result. Right? And the second thing is that these cancellations are stronger at 4 loops than they were at 3 loops, which are in turn stronger than they were at 2 loops. And this is a very unusual thing from traditional supersymmetry. When you expect supersymmetry cancellations to be running out as you go higher and higher in loop order, not getting stronger. And so the question is, what's behind this? What's behind what we're seeing? And I should say that the story's not over. There's a lot of structure to be found. And you can look at these 50 integrals by going to this website. And I encourage you to do so. There's lots of pretty graphs you can rotate. And there is definitely structure to be found here that we certainly haven't exploited. So there we go. So now, so here's just a cartoon of where we are. The green stuff is all the stuff we don't know. And it doesn't matter how big the purple is. If there's any green, then it could diverge. Okay? And so there's no proof of finiteness. There's no rigorous argument for finiteness. There's just that everywhere we've shown a spotlight, and we've shown a spotlight to all loop orders that touches a lot of diagrams, we see cancellations beyond any argument we understand from supersymmetry, but there is no proof of finiteness at all. So this is very much an open question. Okay, so it's instructive to look at pure gravity at 1 loop and actually tree level to try to understand where some of these cancellations might be coming from. And so that's what I'm going to talk about for just a couple of minutes. And so looking for the origins of cancellations, we first consider the behavior of a tree-level diagram. So this is a gravity or a gauge theory diagram, right? But we're going to consider this behavior under a particular shift where we take two legs to infinity along a particular complex direction that's suggested by these on-shell recursion relations. This is exactly the type of shift you take in d dimensions when you've got like a 6-point amplitude and you want to re-express in terms of, you know, 3 or 4-point amplitudes. Anyway, when we take it to infinity in this particular direction, see, Yang-Mills scales is 1 over z, and this is very well behaved if you take z very large. Gravity, however, on this diagram scales very poorly in z to the n minus 2. But when you sum over all the Feynman diagrams to get the actual gravity amplitude, you see a remarkable tree-level cancellation from z to n minus 2 to 1 over z squared. Okay, so gravity trees behave very well, and this is actually very very well understood by a number of people, and you can look here to actually see a derivation. Okay, so want to look at one loop, right? Because one loop is where we saw this big spotlight we shined all the borders. As a it's new by a couple of years now. One loop integration method by Darren Ford, and he actually came up with this to get the rational part of functions you'd miss looking at QCD amplitudes explicitly in four dimensions. If you do in D dimensions, you don't miss anything doing things in the cuts, but if you do things explicitly in four dimensions, there are rational pieces you miss. This is something that captures it. That's why I invented it, but it turns out that this construction allows us to link one loop cancellations to tree level cancellations in any theories. And once we had this tool, we could go ahead and look at gravity. So we did. So this is actually done with Ford and a bunch of sort of the standard crew. So look at loop cancellations and pure gravity. And the thing to take from here is that the majority of cancellations, as you keep adding legs to one loop, are generic to both n equals 8 supergravity and pure gravity. The only thing that n equals 8 supergravity has on top of pure gravity is this finite bit of protection. And that's really interesting. Okay, and so we speculate, this is speculation, that this continues to higher loops. So the majority of the observed n equals 8 multi-loop cancellations are generic to all gravity theories. Not enough to make the observed calculated two-loop divergence in pure Einstein-Hilbert gravity disappear, but that it's not supersymmetry that's responsible for this. All the cancellations we're seeing, what we're speculating, is that most of these cancellations are generic gravity theories. Yes, it could be. And
also, with counting terms, many of them vanish because on shell, I mean, you need zero, and you need really to look at those which.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it could just be. Okay, so here's a summary. On-shell methods are a very powerful way of exploring perturbative quantum field theories. For loop calculation can teach us something very interesting about trees. And straight up perturbative quantum field theory, due to the relative ease of calculation, may have a lot to teach us about fundamental physical principles involving gravity. Equal to supergravity might be finite, it's an open question. Now, I'm going to close with a favorite quote of mine for when I give these sort of technical discussions. My wife's parents gave me this gift when they realized I really was committed to a career in physics, as opposed to potentially more lucrative careers. They told me they just liked the title, but there are other messages involved. In any case, this book has an index. This is very, very detailed in this index, supergravity and n equals 8 theory, and so this is one of my favorite quotes in the book. Although supergravity was indeed a proposal for new unification, it was one that could be expressed and checked only in the context of mind-crushingly boring calculations. And I'd like to humbly suggest a mild correction.
Calculations the hard way. Part of the pain comes from the normalization of sub diagrams that are divergent, overlapping divergences.
You mean when you integrate?
Yeah.
Yes. We were looking at integrands right here. When we actually integrate in the higher dimensions to verify the saturation of the critical dimension, we definitely have to take that into account. That's just a matter of integration. Yeah, I mean, so all the fancy stuff here is just organizing to get the integrands without carrying around all this off-shell baggage. But you know, with everything, I mean, it's all the same. I mean, it is all the same when you integrate. It's the same thing. Yes.
Can you say something about the computer part?
Oh, sure. So. This computer that I'm giving the presentation on is more powerful than the computers used to do the calculation. This was my reward that I gave myself for finishing a for loop calculation. I had one of the older Mac, white plasticky things, the smaller ones. I think I had 2 gigabytes of RAM. I mean, it's not trivial, you know,
no,
2
yes,
gigabytes of RAM.
No, but the
but each individual thing doesn't take that much memory.
Yeah, but the question is, what type of software are you using?
It's
not that computational. I know that it's probably, you know, meter, but. What,
right.
So we
write all our code in Mathematica just because we like the functional language. It's
Maple, no?
Waterloo. Lance likes doing things in Maple. So when Lance integrates, I think Slack is a bunch of Maple. You know, so when Lance integrates, he integrates in Maple.
You get the same answer.
Yes. And that's it. I mean, so one reason actually why there's so many collaborators on these things is a lot of us do the same thing and make sure we're getting the same result. And we do the same. You know, we do things independently and make sure that we're actually coming to the same place. Because a wrong sign can really wreck your life with these types of calculations.
But I'm still coming back to my question.
Okay.
If you have to use a 3-point
vertex
with complex.
Okay, no, so you don't have to.
You have case for it equals 0 on 3 legs going to the same vertex.
So let me
cut, you know, when you do something with a cut, then it's just saying to me that's outside of
That's cheating. It's unfair. So let me tell you, when we verify that we have the right answer, you'll see no 3 vertices here. This is all real momentum. This is all real momentum. Real valid honest, you know, no 3 vertices. Okay. When we verify, right? I have to say I was equally skeptical about pegging things with cubic vertices as well, but you don't need to. It just makes things easier, right? At some point, you're doing something where you don't have any cubic trees, right? You just got 4 trees and 5 trees and 6 trees. At that point, if you wanted to plug in numbers instead of doing things analytically, you plug in real momentum, you know, that satisfies the constraints to verify the left hand side or right hand side.
But it just seems to me that when you're building this up.
Mm-hmm.
You could have some spurious contributions that are not really, you know, the Grundian field theory. In other words, you have a sort. I agree, you have a solution to your constraints and all of that. But I guess what I feel uncomfortable about is that we, along the way, you use things that we know don't exist in the real world.
No, so
and you use a vertex with we mass as particles.
The four cuts
have the fiber. You have an external line that's on shell, and you have 2 internal lines that are also on shell, and all 3 of those are masters. That is not a part of the Grundian field. That doesn't exist.
I'll show you it is a part. It's just not the only part. There's additional bits, right? If you look, there are all sorts of. I'm gonna have to go. Here, let me see if I can take this a little faster here. There are bits here that are certainly satisfied when k squared is 0. Right?
No, it's not just if one k squared is 0. This vertex that you show here has a property that it does not exist. All 3 lines coming into
it. It does with complex momentum.
This is just a concept of conservation of form momentum. I mean, a massless particle cannot decay
with real momentum. You're absolutely right. So if I wanted to plug in numbers to a massless 3 vertex here, I need to use
complex
momentum. That's right.
It does not exist in ordinary, you know, in the real world. Therefore, the question is, have you added in some spurious complex effect? How do you know?
I'll tell you how I know. It's because when I check my calculation using 4 and 5 trees only, or 5 and 6 trees only, or when I sew together a 9 particle tree with a 5 particle tree or a 6 particle tree, I get the same answer, right? And this guy has no complex momenta,
Can you do this calculation without using these three?
Sure, absolutely. No. I mean,
can you throw these vertices that I'm concerned about out of the calculation?
Absolutely.
So you never have to mention them in the calculation.
I could, but I no. So here, let me. So what it would be. So we actually have a name for those cuts, and we call them MHV cuts, and those are cuts that are comprised only of four and five trees, four trees and five particle trees, right? And you can build up the entire amplitude by that. Now, the reason why we don't is because a four tree in gravity has an S, a T, and a U contribution. So that's three possible parents I could have assigned them to, right? And a five tree has 15, right? So it just makes things more complicated. This is just a way of organizing contributions, right? So that's why we start pegging things to a diagram, right? But there's complete freedom for things to move around later when we consider cuts that are formally you'd never use complex momentum.
You're saying something that's different than your collaborators. We don't need anyone.
No, what am I saying that's different from my collaborators?
Well, they say they need those 3 points. They say that there's a system
and that
in order to build up the entire amplitude.
So
let me finish.
Okay, so
they claim they need these things. Now you say that you don't, so I'll have to see. I don't want to argue with you here because
I think I can talk to what they're saying when they're talking about that. They're probably talking about the BCFW on-shell recursion relations, right? That are used to get when you don't know a tree amplitude and it's a 7-point tree amplitude or an 8-point tree amplitude, you can recurse down. Right. Oh, actually, and
no. They're saying to get the loop amplitude. To get, let's say you have an endpoint loop amplitude, you do all the cuts, and then you solve for the rational coefficients you show.
Yes, look.
And in solving, let me finish, in solving for those rational coefficients, these 3-point things are needed. This is what they're telling you.
Oh, were you talking about the one loop QCD calculations? The
Any one loop, this formula you showed, which you said came from Zeppelin and Passerino and others.
Right.
To solve for those coefficients, they claim they need these cuts, and you say you don't.
Well, so those reductions are done on loop gravity before. So the introduction of complex momenta is a very recent thing, right? Like within the past 5 or 6 years.
Byrne has told me that he needs these vertices, and you're saying that you don't.
But he told me he needs. I suggest to consider the discussion during the discussion time. Any other questions? Okay, if not, I suggest we go for our coffee break and we are back around 4:30 and